You sitting comfortable?
Yeah.
So, first things first, can you introduce yourself?
My name is Pat Sheedy.
Can I get you just come in a bit closer to the mic?
My name is Pat Sheedy.
I'll give you the kind of police report version. Patrick Sheedy, 55 years old, born in Moyross, Limerick City, red hair, glasses, maybe 5'8", 5'9". Unmarried, no kids, gambling addict. Lives with his mother in the house where he grew up. Released from prison in August last year after spending 3 years in jail for a number of fraud-related offences. He has over 100 previous convictions.
So if you remember, there was a phone call to the office with a number for me to ring, followed up by, I think, a text for me to ring this particular number. I ring the number and it's him in prison. And he says to me, how did you get my number? And he's all nervous. And I say to him, look, I'm not trying to cause you any problems here. Somebody told me to phone you that you had some information about Brian Kenny. Look, some people listening to this might remember the name Brian Kenny. So he was the kind of the villain, you know, in the book and the podcast that you and I made with Joey O'Callaghan, the witness in his own words. So Brian Kenny was basically this milkman in Dublin back in the mid-90s. But while he was delivering milk, he was also a drug dealer and a sexual abuser who took over Joey's life from when he was about 11 years old. And Kenny is doing this life sentence now for murder because of Joey and Joey's testimony in the courts. And he's been in prison for nearly 20 years because of Joey. So when I'm talking to Pat and he's there in Lock and House in the open prison with Brian Kenny, I'm obviously interested. And obviously, if somebody just sent in a message saying, ring this number, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
But he had information about Brian Kenny. And in the very first phone call, he told me who he was. He told me where he was. And then said he was nervous. And I said, right, well, look, I was very anxious to get this information about Brian Kenny from him. So the second call, he then phoned me back and he apologised for being a bit nervous. He just said that he'd worked out who gave me the number and said it was a prison officer and that he was just a bit nervous and that he wasn't supposed to be speaking to me, obviously, but that he was kind of going to go out of his way to give me this information, that he'd all this information on him.
He works in the tuck shop now in Wheatfield. That's what he does. Packs up the prisoners' shop orders every week. Generally, he's not allowed to mix with people.
Yeah.
Put him in with the likes of me because they knew I wasn't a threat to him. But anybody who would be remotely violently inclined would want to kill him. He's really not a nice fella.
And then he just started giving me information. I didn't really want it. Not that I was going to refuse it, but I never did anything much of the information. It was all calls. It was a constant barrage of calls after that. He was ringing me at night. He was ringing and ringing and ringing. If I didn't answer, he'd keep ringing. Little bits of information about people in prison, little bits of stories, little bits of this, that and the other.
Like, it's a scary place, prison, when you're locked in a confined space like that. The things you hear, the banging on the doors, people screaming, everything about it is haunting, I suppose. You know, there's certain sounds that'll stay with me for the rest of my life now.
He started to filter into the conversations a bit about his life and how he was so different and he wasn't somebody that should have been in prison. You know, he began to become interesting about that kind of stuff. And he certainly appears to have these sort of middle-class manners and accent, and he's intelligent, he's articulate. He didn't seem to have an agenda against anybody. You know, he seemed to be like a fish out of water in this environment. And I kind of began to feel a bit sorry for him. I thought he's quite lonely. On occasion, I would have made a bit of time for him. Like in the evening, I might have taken a call from him, or I might have phoned him back what I wouldn't have otherwise with somebody else.
I was lucky. I didn't have a wife or small kids at home. Like, my heart went out to guys, see him fighting to make a last phone call home, a 6-minute phone call to tell their kids how much they love him and stuff like that. Look, it's easy, and people that'll be watching this or whatever will turn around and go, oh well, he shouldn't have done what he done then, should he? That's easy for them to say. You know, there's a reason behind everything, and there's a reason behind why everyone is in prison, and it can be a heartbreaking place, you know.
He told me he was writing a book about his life, and it was all about his gambling problems, how it had affected his life and his family, his stints in rehab, the scams he'd pulled to fund the whole thing, and how they'd eventually landed him in prison. He'd been working on it with the creative writing teacher in the prison, and he'd won an award for one of his stories at the Listowel Writers' Festival, which is, you know, one of the most respected literary festivals in the country. So I was kind of impressed.
I think I probably suggested a podcast because I was quite taken in by his story, this story of redemption, the story of this guy, this very mild-mannered man who had been consumed by his gambling addiction. You know, when he started speaking about how wealthy he had been as a businessman, how successful he had been and how he'd lost it all. And I thought, gambling is such a huge issue. It's always so difficult to get somebody from the darkness to come out and talk to you and be articulate enough. Felt educated, felt like somebody who had an understanding of his addiction because of his long-term relationship with the Gambling Anonymous. How he really was definitely turning his world around, and he wanted to do something to highlight the problem of gambling. And it just all seemed like a easy project to work on and something of value and worthwhile. And that's what we spoke about. There was a kind of a reason to do it.
So that was what, like 18 months ago now? That first contact?
Yeah, it would have been.
It's been a long journey, much longer than we probably expected at the start. And look, he's published his book now. It's out there on the shelves, and he's out there on the radio and on the TV right now, doing interviews with the Irish Times and interviews with Pat Kenny, doing podcasts.
Pat Sheedy, good afternoon. You're welcome.
By a man whose compulsive gambling led to 100...
Pat Sheedy, good morning and welcome.
Pat, you're very welcome to episode.
Sorry, I'm just Thanks, talking Richie. To my guest today, Pat Sheedy, about the promotion of...
And I have a kind of uneasy feeling when I see that. Like, it makes me nervous, honestly. You've been a crime journalist for 25 years. You've probably seen everything there is to see out there in terms of criminals and their personalities, what they get up to. But I don't know. I think this feels kind of different to anything we've worked on before. Pat Sheedy isn't your typical criminal. I mean, he's not some violent drug dealer. He's not a murderer. He's a pretty ordinary guy with a gambling addiction. And that addiction has brought him to some crazy places in his life, like including prison. At the same time, though, dealing with this guy, trying to tell his story, it's more complicated than I thought it would be. And I think that's because we don't know for sure if we can trust him.
I can honestly say that there's no word in that book that isn't true. It's probably the most honest thing I've ever done in my life.
Well, this will be even more honest, I guarantee you, by the time we're done.
We called him Shady Shady. It was just all... shadows.
Pat was some chancer, but he was a heart of gold underneath it all, Nicholas.
Somebody rang me and said, watch out for this guy. This guy, you can't trust this guy.
He had this incredible ability to convince people who were left absolutely shocked that they'd been talking to a con man.
He committed a crime, he broke every law in the book.
He did some swindles, unbelievable swindles. I don't know how he had the nerve.
He's a piece of shit.
So he's just going to keep doing this, and somebody's going to end up hurt.
I'm Nicola Tallant.
And I'm Ian Mullaney.
From Wine Tavern Productions, in association with Go Loud, this is The Gambler, Episode 1, Shady Sheedy.
I went through a period of, given my grandiosity, I used to call it being in between apartments. Basically, I was homeless, but I could never admit that to myself. You know, I'd live in an apartment for 2 or 3 months and then I wouldn't be paying the rent and they'd come and kick me out. And I used to stay in hotels or B&Bs for a short period of time. I'd book in with the company name, leave without paying. They'd know where the company was. So eventually what had happened is an invoice would come in the door at work. There'd be hell to pay. The boss would be roaring and screaming at me, but he'd always pay because I was always making him more money than anyone else. He'd deduct it from my wages. It was a kind of a cycle, something like that going on. There was a hotel out there in Dublin. And I booked in there. I didn't know who owned it. I didn't know anything of it. Booked in 4 nights under the company name. Got there the first night. It was great. Second night, met the manageress, giving her all the flannel about the job. Told, because we used to run events, told her that we might even run an event or two there, giving just all the bullshit to develop the trust so I wouldn't have to pay when I was leaving and that she'd send the bill on. And I remember on the third night, I came in and she called me over, good looking girl, called me over. She said, Patch, the manager wants to meet you, just wants to have a chat with you about events going forward and stuff. I said, yeah, grand. I said, she said, he's upstairs there, just go through the main doors when you go up that flight of stairs and go in there and wait. So I went up and I went into a big meeting room that was completely empty and there was one chair in the middle, and when I got in, the door was shut behind me and three or four guys kind of stood around the door, and next thing, in another door came this little guy, dark hair, stocky, sallow skin, foreign accent. I found out subsequently who he is and that he was Italian. I thought he was maybe Middle Eastern, I didn't know. And he just started laughing. He told me that he knew that I was there as a scam and he wanted his money and he wanted it now. I think I had like 20 quid in my wallet or something like that, so there's no way I had it. So the doors were locked. He goes away. He comes back in with the good looking manageress. She stood by the window and he produces this mallet, kind of a lump hammer thing with a big metal head on it. And I just went, oh Jesus. I genuinely did not know what to do. I couldn't get off the chair for fear. Even if I wanted to get up and run, I was stuck to the chair. He just looked at me and he just said, see this? It's going off your head in an hour, he said, if I haven't got my money. And I was like, this is Wednesday evening or something. Like, what the fuck am I going to do? And I didn't know. And I sat there for nearly the hour, literally in my head, every bullshit excuse that I was trying to come up with. What kind of a story can I tell this guy now to get me off my back? They took my phone. I had no way of calling the guards and no way of calling anything like that. And then I just said, fuck it, I'm going to have to ring my boss. So with about 5 minutes left in the hour, I rang. As I rang, I told him what happened and he just hung up the phone on me. They went away again for about another 20 minutes and they came back in. No sign of the boss. So I was going, here we go, I'm getting it. He just turned around and he said something to your woman, the manager, the pretty looking manageress. And all I can remember, it's the one thing I really remember about the night, was she just went to grab the hammer off of him and she said, let me have a swing at the prick. And I just went, oh Jesus, they're serious, like they're really going to kill me. And then the door opened up and he was called out, so he went out and he just said, it's your lucky day. So I went downstairs and I could see my boss with a friend of his at reception, paid the bill. So I got my stuff, and I'm not exaggerating, I literally couldn't stand up with the fright that I got. And then I'd found out subsequently then by making an inquiry or two that this guy was heavily involved in the IRA or something. I was going to get killed.
So you hadn't a clue that hotel was... Yeah.
Not a clue.
And you sort of scammed...
the wrong people.
This story about the hotel and the hammer, what do you make of that?
I don't really know. Like, parts of it seem legit. And, like, I did some digging and I found out that, yes, there definitely was some paramilitary involvement at that very hotel. Mm-hmm. But he definitely has some contacts in prison that could have confirmed that for him or told him that.
Yeah.
Whether it happened exactly the way he said it happened, I just don't know.
And that's kind of the problem, isn't it? Like, as a story, it kind of seems too good to be true. Like, there's this one bit.
I went into a big meeting room that was completely empty and there was one chair in the middle, and when I got in, the door was shut behind me and three or four guys kind of stood around the door, and next thing, in another door came this little guy, dark hair, stocky, sallow skin, foreign accent. I found out subsequently who he is and that he was Italian. I thought he was maybe Middle
Eastern. And that's a bit cinematic for me.
Yeah, it's a bit Hollywood, all right.
It is. You know, I wonder if it really was a good-looking manageress, for instance, or if she really said, let me take a swing at the prick. And like, why would some paramilitary guy threaten to kill him over a bill that wasn't even due to be paid yet?
Like, he's telling you the story and it all sounds plausible and you don't really question it in the moment, but the more you listen to it, the more you start to wonder.
Deep down, once you're gambling and once I'm actively gambling, I know that there's going to be scams, because I couldn't justify earning €1 million a week if I was gambling. It would be the same to me as earning 200, because it's all going the same place, it's all going the same way. So there has to be crime where there's gambling with me. That's just the reality of it for me. It took me a long time to realise that, but that's where gambling brings me. It brings me to courthouses, Garda stations and prisons.
Because you want to gamble more money, or because the scamming is goes gambling along with it? It's another rush.
The gambling initially was all about money. It was all about making money. It was all about that big win. I'd say around 2015, when the shit that I'm in jail now for started, then it wasn't about the money. The realisation was there with me at that point that gambling's for mugs. I'm a mug. I'm never going to get rich out of it. But then it was just about, I still can't figure out what it was about. It was just me being completely off the wall, completely reckless. I didn't care. I knew I was going to prison. I knew that I'd been caught. I knew that I was heading where I was heading. And gambling became an escape to me. It was where I locked myself away in that little room at home. I stopped going out with my friends. I stopped taking their calls. And I just sat there and lied to my mother, and I lied to myself, and I lied to everybody for a couple of years, until I ended up behind bars.
So how much do you think you made or lost?
Up to 2010. When you're in treatment, you do a thing called a step 4 and a step 5. It's called a fearless moral inventory, where you look at everything, basically, about what you did while you were actively gambling or whatever the case may be. And I did a financial inventory where I added up what I had legitimately earned, what I'd borrowed legitimately, and what I'd stolen and scammed. And my figure at that point would have been close on $1 million, $1.5 million. Now it's definitely 2 or over 2. I know that's an astronomical amount of money to some people. To me, it's nothing, because I never saw it. I had no appreciation for money. I had no concept of what it was or what it meant. It was just like confetti to me. Like, when I was in Dublin and I was on a Wednesday or a Thursday night, and I wasn't able to pull a stroke for whatever reason, or I had no money and I was hungry and I had 3 or 4 quid in my pocket, if I went into Bookies and turned it into 10 or 15 quid so I could go to the chipper and have a fine big dinner, I'd be over the moon. And the next day I could walk out with 3 grand wages, turn it into 10 or 15 and not care. So that's what it did to me. And, you know, if that's not mental illness, I don't know what is. You know, if anybody can tell me that gambling isn't a serious illness when it does things like that to people. And I've heard worse stories than me. That's the scary thing. Like,
do you mean there's somewhere worse for you to go if you ever went back?
Without a doubt. There's always somewhere worse. I used to always be told by counsellors or whatever that I had to hit my rock bottom. It's a term in addiction and in recovery, that you'll never get better until you hit your rock bottom. And, you know, I thought going to prison was my rock bottom. But since I've been in prison, I can honestly tell you, I don't have a rock bottom, I don't think. And I don't think any addict does, because it's literally there for me any day of the week that I want to do it. And I know for a fact that the next time I do go at it, it's going to be bigger again and again and again. You know, it's not something that just stops because I stop. It grows and it keeps growing and it keeps growing. And I know that if I do go back, the next stroke will be bigger. It'll be for a bigger amount of money. I will get caught and I'll end up with a bigger prison sentence. I know this. So, you know, I just have to make sure, as best I can, that I don't go down that road again.
There's no going back now. The amount of publicity that I got as a result of all this shit, everybody and their dog now know what I've done. Even if I wanted to try and be something I wasn't or inveigle my way in with these so-called nice people or whatever. I know now that there's no chance of that. It took a long time to get the level of appreciation I have for what I have as opposed to what I want. But I have that now. You know, and just hope I hold on to it. That's the thing, you know. I could have had this conversation with you 10 years ago when I came out of treatment, and I'd have sat down and I'd probably be giving you this big, whole, lovely, wholesome, earnest talk again and tell you that I've learned my lesson and that, you know, I'm never going to do that again and all that kind of stuff. I'm never going to say that again in my life because I can't. That's just being completely honest with you. I know what's going to happen to me tomorrow. I don't. I know I can control what I'm doing today. That's okay. But this business of making promises and plans and all that, that's the kind of shit that gets me into trouble. Gambling, I'd say, is probably only about 20% of my problem. The gambling is the end of the line. The gambling is how I react to other shit. Other people might drink if they have problems. They might take drugs if they have problems. I gamble. But I realise that I have so many other flaws and shit that I need to sort out. And once I sort all that shit out, I don't have the need to gamble. I haven't a pot to piss in today. I'm out on temporary release for 4 days. I get a check for 155 quid off the social welfare. That 155 quid would have lasted maybe 10 seconds if I was gambling. It'd be gone. Or else it'd be turned into thousands and then it'd be off again. I've just had to realise and accept that I am mentally ill as well as every other, and I am. You can dress it up whatever way you want. It's a disease I have. And I need to, you know, I just need to manage it. So as long as I keep doing that, I'm fine. And writing that book was, I can't describe the amount of shit that just literally I felt like washing off me when I was doing it. Because that's the only honest thing. I can honestly say that there's no word in that book that isn't true. And it's probably the most honest thing I've ever done in my life.
Well, this will be even more honest, I guarantee you, by the time we're done.
We've spent a lot of time with this guy, you know, meeting up with him every time he's getting out of prison on temporary release, days driving around Limerick with him, spending hours and hours talking to him. And I think we probably lost our minds a little bit trying to figure out if what he was telling us was actually true. And I don't really know when we started to get sceptical, but...
You're not going to believe this. I'm just driving into Limerick, okay? And I'm after swerving in because I saw Pat standing at a bus stop on Musgrave Street, is it?
You remember the day we drove down to Limerick to spy on him? I think by that time, we were pretty suspicious.
So I'm going to just do my damnedest to follow this bus. He certainly isn't expecting me to be where I am.
No.
At the moment.
But it got really bad. Like, I think we really started to worry that, you know, maybe we can't believe any of this.
Yeah.
Right, okay, so he's told you a lie.
Yeah.
Okay, that's bizarre.
He's definitely lied, Camino.
He's definitely lied. He's lied flat out to there.
Like, we know he's got problems. We know he's had a very difficult time with addiction and he's trying to rebuild his life after being in prison. And you have to recognize that and have sympathy for that. You don't ever want to put somebody like that in a position that they can't handle. And you don't want to put their recovery at risk. But like you say, it's not easy to shake the feeling. Am I being lied to? After all, he told us himself, like, he lied for a living.
You see, you think you haven't. There's a little bit of truth, as you say.
Yeah, always a little bit. But how much is the question? Yeah.
I've started to wonder just how good a liar he was or is. He's getting a few hundred quid out of somebody with a sob story, or he's getting things on credit like phones or rugby tickets and not paying for them, or he's taking money for things he doesn't really have to sell. None of it is exactly rocket science, you know? It's unpleasant, but it's not elaborate.
Yeah, and the weird part of it is he seemed to do these things knowing he was going to be caught.
No, I knew I was going to get caught from day one. And I don't know whether it's my subconscious that wanted to get caught all the time, but I can honestly tell you that practically every scam I pulled, I always left the door open either by using my own name, my own phone number, or made it very easy for me to get caught.
And I've never really come to terms with this part of his MO. Like, how do you even begin to understand someone who does things like that? And like, how do you trust them?
See, I don't know if you ever really can.
I need to talk to you about something, right? And it's entirely up to you what way kind of you give me an answer on this or not. But I started out doing this with you thinking, and I understand the whole concept of a podcast like this. It's not to me making me out to be a fantastic person or anything like that or whatever. But if it's just going to be something that's just going to destroy me, like, I need to know.
I don't think either of us have any interest in destroying you.
No. Yeah, okay, and that's fair enough. But, like, you have to see this from my point of view. I don't know where I'm at. My head's fucking wrecked for the last few weeks on this.
But in a way,
the only way
the checks and balances we're doing is protecting you.
Yeah. Like, it protects everyone if everything that goes into it is true. We came into this with the exact same thoughts as you did. We thought it's a good story and let's tell it. We've never been any other way. We just have to go to lengths to tell it properly, because if we don't, and the whole thing's going to fall apart, you know?
Like, the whole reason, and I know you'd probably start laughing, because you know, I am what I am, but the whole reason I wrote the book and the whole reason I'm doing this kind of thing is I'd like fucking people to be able to listen to it and look at it and go, fuck, that could be me. And maybe if they learn something by listening to it and it helps some people, like, because I wouldn't wish the life I had on anyone, and that's been honest. I wouldn't wish the life I've put myself through on anyone, and no one made me do anything ever in my life. Like, this is all me.
The difficult thing with Pat is that he has this really good story to tell, but it's just so hard to believe him. There's like this mask there sometimes, like he's not opened up in the way I expected him to, the way I would probably expect of anyone who really wants to tell their story. And I think you particularly have felt, you know, manipulated at times. And this kind of thing is actually like really hard to live with, like in any relationship. So you end up questioning everything, you even really small stuff, silly stuff. And you're questioning yourself most of all, like getting yourself all worked up in knots, wondering, am I being too cynical, too judgmental? Or am I the one being played here? Like, is this a real story or is it just another scam? And all the while you're going, like, who is this guy? Who is he really? And honestly, I still don't know the answer to that.
I get notions in my head. I thought I might be able to make something myself with the book or something. I don't know. I don't know what I wanted. I don't know why I was fucking... I don't know why I even think these things, to be honest with you. I've had my fair share of bad publicity. I'm not... I'll be honest with you. I really don't give a fuck what's said about me anymore. To be honest with you, I've been down that road and, you know, I've come out the other side of it. Like, but what I am trying to do is I am trying to do something different with myself now. You know, because it's the last chance I'll have if I can make an Anthony of myself. I'll just be glad when everything is fucking over this time next year, when no one knows about me anymore, and go back into a little hole in the ground. I'm just really sorry I ever got involved in any of this kind of thing. Anything at all. My own fault. It's just typical fucking me. Trying to be something I'm not.
Like, we're standing back now and looking with big cynical heads on us, Adam.
Yeah. None of it's stuff that you're going to question in the middle of a conversation.
Yeah.
None of it's stuff that's really going to stop you in your tracks.
Yeah.
But, like, that's not sustainable in the kind of relationship that we have with him, where it's something that, you know...
But you see, he didn't know what he was getting into here. He's sort of bitten off a little bit too much. Because he had no idea. He just thought he could tell his story the way he wanted to. He thought he was going to be in control here, and he's not.
The Gambler is produced and presented by Nicola Tallant and me, Ian Malini. The executive producer for Go Loud is Owen Brennan, and Darren Cleary is the commissioning editor for Go Loud. Sound design is by Neil Kavanagh. The Go Loud promotion design and video team for The Gambler is Roisin Riley, Siobhan Walsh, Cameron Rooney, Andrew McConnell, and Dara Murphy. Legal support was from Mars Solicitors. If you have been affected by any of the issues raised in this series, you can contact Gambling Care on 1800 936 725 or visit gamblingcare.ie.
In the next episode of The Gambler.
But that would have been one of the lower things I would have done, I think. You know, there were neighbours, there were good people. It was just a horrible thing to do. And then the worst thing that ever happened to me in my life happened to me. I did a bet, and the bet won.
Keep listening to The Gambler for more.